Beethoven Matters with David Dubal and Jed Distler is a special program produced by the Classical Network. Funding for this program is provided in part by listener members like you.
When he heard the Fifth Symphony, Goethe said, "This man will destroy civilization as we know it."
This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and Beethoven matters more than ever. I am here with my dear friend and colleague at the Classical Network, David Dubal.
I'm honored to be on the same station in my show, The Piano Matters, with Jed, who is one of the purest minds. I don't mean just pure of mind, but pure in his desire to make all of us love music the way he does.
Well, speak for yourself about yourself. I use those same words about you. And we are going to be exploring so many aspects of Beethoven. So I invite you to listen.
And I hope that throughout the year, we have a chance to communicate to you our love, admiration of Beethoven.
David Dubal, in the first hour of this program, we got onto the topic of editions of the piano sonatas of Beethoven, printed editions with various editors, many of whom have been famous pianists, like Eugene Delbert, who was Liszt's pupil, Arthur Schnabel, of course. And I forgot to ask you about Claudio Arrau, who was a wonderful Beethoven interpreter. His name often comes up on both of our programs, and I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about the Arrau edition, because I forgot to ask you.
I can tell you that the Arrau edition is fabulous.
Yes.
It's fabulous. Scrupulous and also imaginative, and most interesting fingerings.
Yes, because the fingerings come out of his practical experience with performing them, whereas with Schnabel, I once asked Karl Ulrich Schnabel about his father's edition, and he said, well, the fingerings may seem strange, but I asked my father about it, and he said they are didactic fingerings, not so much practical fingerings, which is interesting.
Well, the Schnabel edition, which was first published by Knopf, an actual publisher,
A book publisher, not a music publisher. Yeah. That's so interesting.
Well, he was a tremendously regarded intellectual. And he like Landowska, the doctors of New York and the philosophers would never miss a Schnabel performance. And just like no pianist would miss a Horowitz performance.
Well, they would say that it didn't matter so much if you had a ticket to a Schnabel concert, but they wouldn't let you in if you didn't have a score to the Beethoven sonatas.
That's a lot of page turning.
Indeed. Another question, which is, where does the proverbial twain meet between Beethoven, the idealist, who we speak about so much, and the other side of the coin, Beethoven the populist, musically speaking? And how does one reconcile these seemingly opposite characteristics?
You mean the Beethoven that is beloved by thousands everywhere without necessarily knowing that he's a great composer as a theoretical thing? Is that what you mean by populist?
I think so. And also the fact that he wrote pot boilers like Wellington's Victory. He wrote very accessible sets of variations. He wrote pieces that are very easy to grasp, such as the finale from the Seventh Symphony, the apotheosis of the dance. But then you also have the Beethoven of the late quartets, which have so many cryptic and not very easy to grasp at first hearing.
Well, they were not in Beethoven's lifetime really understood, and it took many, many years to accommodate the public to in any way understanding the, as Sullivan calls it, the states of consciousness of these late quartets. Let me just say that as much as the last sonatas, which are certainly often great triumphs of the human mind, by the time he gets to the inwardness and total almost zen isolation of his late works, he goes totally deaf in every way by 1825. These works will never be the spoken language of the public. I mean, the whole repertoire relies on his middle period alone, and they are very great. But getting to a potboiler like Wellington Symphony or other things he did, to me, even a potboiler is the fantasy for piano and orchestra and chorus.
Yes, that's a really good example. I didn't think about that, but that's very much in that vein.
Let me say this to you, Jed. It's interesting. When I first heard this piece, I was with a friend of mine, a good pianist. I was, 18 or 17, 19, and already had, of course, a knowledge of Beethoven probably above my age, and had played about 9 or 7, 10 or whatever piano sonatas. I saw this impressive chorus in the pianist, and I couldn't believe it, and I couldn't stop it. The fact is I started laughing. I couldn't stop. I said, this is Beethoven at not only at his worst, every cliche he ever could possibly think of was in this piece. I hate it so much and still do. It's effective. And he wrote these four, in this case, of course, for himself. But I don't think any set of variations is merely populist. I think every one of them are masterful, not of the level, let's say, of the Eroica or the Diabelli, or even the F major opus 34, No, this man, whatever he touched. I like the Wellington, I like all the junk, and why not? I mean, this is a man that did not work for a living as we have had to, or Mozart did, or everyone else. He knew that that's his job, to create a life that would financially keep him going, not just the great patrons.
One of Beethoven's most popular pieces actually was his Septet, Opus 20. And I think he was kind of annoyed that this was such a hit with the public, in contrast to, well, perhaps some other pieces that Beethoven might have wanted to be noticed more. Personally, I think the Septet is so full of charm and wit, and I've got a fabulous performance here of the finale, which has a slow introduction, and then it goes into a rather fast march. These are members of the Tonhall Orchestra of Zurich, conducted by David Zinman. Music of Beethoven, the finale from the Septet.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've just heard Music of Beethoven, the finale from his septet, Opus 20, with members of the Tonhall Orchestra of Zurich, conducted by David Zinman. You are listening to a program called Beethoven Matters. This is a special birthday Beethoven tribute. My name is Jed Distler. I am the artist in residence for the Classical Network, and I host a weekly program called Between the Keys. I am here with my fellow Classical Network colleague and dear friend, David Dubal, who, of course, is the longtime host for the weekly program called The Piano Matters, of which I am an avid listener, David. So, David, what does Beethoven's piano writing tell you about him as a pianist?
Well, it's the first great pianist who is exploring. I mean, Mozart's concertos and solo sonatas are exquisitely written, and they're very difficult, much more difficult than people can imagine. But Beethoven now has a new view of instruments.
He has, in what sense?
Well, let's say this. All of the new mechanisms of the piano-building world were within Beethoven's time, even though he was not happy with any of them. And one of his letters are very revealing. He says, you know, of all the instruments, it's the piano just doesn't come up to what he wanted. And what does that really mean with Beethoven when his whole life is with the piano at all times? But what about him as a pianist? Well, never had anyone displayed such emotionality and volcanic music coming from the keyboard. Remember, it wasn't just the sonatas that were being premiered, you know, every 6 months or something at the Lichnowsky's or whoever else. He was the greatest extempore player that had ever lived up to that time on a piano. He had small rivals like Wolf or Hummel, but the basic Beethoven was a real pounder. I mean, he had at his disposal a heavier piano than Mozart's Walter piano. Well, he had a Walter piano for a while, Beethoven.
Certainly heavier than what Clementi came up with.
No, Clementi's pianos were actually harder action than the Viennese. He liked the Viennese pianos better than the English. Even the Broadwood, which has such currency of, you know, popularity. Oh, my God, what a wonderful thing the Broadwood people did. Well, it wasn't just him. Moscheles, Ries, all of his students in England, all of the great musicians of England at that time also bought it for him. It wasn't just some gift. The Erard of 1803 is an interesting piano because now he has what Mozart or no earlier pianist Dussek or anyone else had. He had the doubleless, the new kind of, not double escapement yet, that comes in 1821, but a very refined escapement where the repeated notes could come out. And this is an interesting thing. I've speculated on it. He kept it even after he didn't like it. And he told his brother that he kept it because it's a souvenir. No one else had ever had a souvenir like that. Think of this, you see, by 33, when he got this, he was already very well known, comparatively speaking. Not like Haydn, of course. That's the most celebrated composer in the world. But he's known enough that Erard in Paris sends him this piano. And eventually, by around 1815, when he gets the Broadwood around that time, he gives it as a gift to his brother. Oh, we always think, oh, the brother, you know, those nothing brothers. They were also very musical, but of course no genius. So the refinement of the Erard was interesting, but what's more interesting is how did he really get it? Did really Beethoven's music really go into Paris musical life, which was very, very superficial and still opera-oriented. They didn't even know what chamber music was.
I think we should hear an example of a piano from Beethoven's time after everything you've been talking about. David, you spoke about the Walter instrument, and I've got a recording of a forte piano that was painstakingly reconstructed based on the model of a Walter piano, vintage, oh, I guess, 1802. So In the first hour, I was speaking about Beethoven's Pathetique Sonata, which you first turned me on to many years ago, David, when I listened to your programs on WNCN. This is back in the 1970s. I'm revealing my age. Let's hear the rondo finale from the Pathetique Sonata, played on a forte piano based upon an instrument of Beethoven's time. The pianist is Ronald Brautigam.
Thank you.
Ronald Brautigam playing on a forte piano modeled after a Walter piano vintage 1802 in Music of Beethoven, the Rondo Finale from his Piano Sonata No. 8 in C minor, Opus 13, known as the Pathétique. This is Jed Distler, and I am here with David Dubal. We are speaking about why Beethoven matters. In the first hour, you told this amazing story about how the composer Hector Berlioz attended a performance of Beethoven's late quartet in C-sharp minor at the Paris Conservatory, and this was at a time when really nobody knew this work, certainly not in Paris in the mid-19th century, and that there were 12 people in the audience. Unbelievable. But there was another important performance that Berlioz attended that I wanted to mention. Berlioz also was present when Liszt played Beethoven's Hammerklavier Sonata, which was a piece that, unlike most of Beethoven's earlier sonatas, this was a piece not really designed to play at home.
Well, as Charles Rosen said, this is the one work that separates for all time the amateur and the professional.
Or, as my high school gym teacher said, separates the men from the cupcakes.
Oh, you said it. Well, you know, you've just written a tremendous article on the Hammerklavier for gramophone, and I think it'll be read by many, many people. This is a work of mythic proportion and greatness.
Well, I was comparing many, many recordings.
Yeah, yeah. And there should always be many recordings of it. But it was not known at all in Paris. And Berlioz said Liszt uncovered the enigma of the Hammerklavier for him.
What we would do to hear Liszt play it. You've performed Beethoven all of your life, and you've taught Beethoven, and you've programmed Beethoven on the radio.
Sure.
And you may well have heard, if not every recording ever made of Beethoven's music, certainly quite a few. How has Beethoven interpretation evolved over the past decades, for better or for worse?
Well, it always, Jed, will depend upon the artist and his gifts. We have to understand that performers are often conservative people, and they are taken in by, oh, yes, Beethoven. As Arau said to me, they're not coming to hear me. They're coming to congratulate themselves on coming to hear Beethoven and me. And that's what happens to the pianists. There's so much glorious talk about him and his works that if you don't really understand or feel him, like Percy Grainger, he thought it was all military music.
And he was quite a Beethoven hater.
He hated it. And I understand exactly why. He's a Democrat where all musics of every country was wonderful. Yeah, if you asked the Hindu, and they had asked them, what do you think of Beethoven's music? They also said something like, it's very martial, very, you know. Well, it is. We're moving into the democratic ascendancy where the individual now counts on a new level. Beethoven was definitely thinking about immortality, as Bach never did. Bach said, I worked hard. That was all he ever said. Mozart, my God, if he's just hoping to get another commission, things like that. Mm-hmm. But Beethoven, no. He writes the Hammerklavier and he says, you know, here's a piece that pianists will suffer over, so to speak, in 50 years. 50 years was a long time in that moment. Remember, that moment is the end of a 55-year Viennese period, which includes all of Haydn, all of Mozart, all of Clementi, and so forth. Much shorter time than rock and roll has had in our time, 70 years or something like that. So, I should include Schubert in that. He's part of that Viennese time. So that Hammerklavier and all of his sonatas were not known. So I surmise this, and I think so. The real great patron of Beethoven's youth before such Viennese aristocrats, and of course the Archduke Rudolf, we can never thank him enough for the money he gave for these 25 dedications, including the Hammerklavier, including the 111, including the Les Adieux, which he would not finish until the Archduke would come back from the leaving Vienna when it was taken over for the second time in a decade by Napoleon.
I want to lead you back to the evolution of performers.
Yeah, okay, yes.
You were talking about Claudio Arrau. Mm-hmm. One big thing that has come into play over the last half century is the prevalence of so-called historically informed performances, original instruments, rethinking the music in terms of the old instruments, and how some of that has informed people who are playing modern instruments.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to hear. I don't think we can ever have anything more than a historical echo of what they heard. The Graf piano would be the closest, the 1825 Graf, which that firm gave to Beethoven on permanent loan. That would sound more like, still very grainy, but it would have the Viennese mechanism, which he adored, which meant he could not have to practice as much. And by 1825, though, he had never heard anything on the Graf, nothing that he had ever played. He was totally stone deaf.
What would you ask Beethoven if you could ask him only one question?
Well, you know, I wouldn't have wanted to ask him anything because I don't think he was socially gifted in any way. And he would just say, you know, you're eating too much, or, you know, why do you sleep so much, or come into the forest with me. We'll take a walk, but let's not talk. I don't think he was very articulate in the sense that you are, or even I am. But I would ask him one thing. And it would be, of course, pre-real deafness. Please, please, Maestroso. I wouldn't call him Maestro. I would give him a new name, Maestroso. I don't think that's ever been used. I would say, Maestroso, could you play for me for 15 minutes, one of your sonatas or movements or anything?
Several decades ago, James Methuen Campbell wrote a book about Chopin playing, and every chapter was devoted to different styles of Chopin playing, the French school, the German school, the Argentine school, the American school. And it got me thinking, what if Chopin read this book? What would he think? I think he would be completely amused and baffled.
He would be horrified.
He'd be horrified. And it got me thinking, if Chopin was transformed, if Chopin was transplanted to the late 20th, early 21st century and asked, okay, who's the authentic Chopin pianist? If he heard all of these performances and all these recordings, what would my fantasy be? What would he say? And I bet his answer would shock all of us.
Oh, I'm sure, but I don't know what it is. What do you think?
He might. Would he say Arthur Rubinstein?
Oh, God, no.
Or would he say Long Long?
Oh, God.
Would he say Horowitz?
No.
Would he say Claudio Arrau?
No. It would be too outside, too heavyweight for him. No.
Jean-Marie Daré?
No, it's too dry-lipped. No. Remember, when all of these famous pianists are very good, we can go back to that question on what has happened, you know, in Beethoven. As I said, I started to say, well, he's status. I mean, wow, if, you know, Schnabel in 1930 could spend, you know, years doing all of this, oh, I can do them. So we have, you know, dozens now of people doing these Beethoven sonatas. Well, what do they mean to me? I mean, I can't finish a complete so-and-so because he doesn't have the gift of temperament to play more than maybe four sonatas of the 32 very well. I've talked to really some important pianists, and I say, oh, what do you think of Opus 78, the little two-movement work? Which one is that? Which, you see, mm-hmm. It takes a long time, and this person recorded them all, you see. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about Arrau, you're talking about a great comprehensive musician of the 19th century, where art was art with a capital A, and it was not, you know, therapy or studying at a conservatory. Liszt's worst quip would be when a student played at his master class, he says, you go to a conservatory, not me, you know. Mm-hmm. And that is what the playing is. It's conservatory playing. It's careful. It doesn't have the rough edges that Beethoven would have had. He would have absolutely, except in the most refined slow movements and other things, he would miss notes. He would laugh at that. He would splash. He would over-pedal. He would be volcanic. And you would find much more of the real Beethoven in his performances.
Because then. Performance was a process. It wasn't a product.
Exactly. A composer was an instrumentalist as well. And without that, you have a very great lack of creativity and imagination in modern pianists. They're really just, you know, people that sit at the piano and have a certain natural musicality, or they've imitated from records because most of them have good ears. And they, it's easy to, you know, play like this one or that one. And it all infiltrates into a conglomeration of absolutely non-Beethoven. Doesn't mean a thing to me. And I say this really with almost being mad. I don't want Beethoven pursued by any little talent that has the fingers to play him. Is that my coffee?
Yes, that's your coffee. That's your espresso. We are recording this in the morning, but it will air at night, just in case that you think David Dubal and I are getting our caffeine fix after the sun goes down. That's not the case. But David, if you want to hear something creative and way off the beaten track, we've been talking about the Beethoven Hammer Clavier Sonata, as we often do. So my friend, the composer and pianist Fridrik Jevsky, performed the Hammer Clavier years ago in concert, and he added improvisation in each movement. So while we go and replenish our espresso cups, let's listen to the scherzo movement of Beethoven's Hammer Clavier Sonata, Opus 106, with Fridrik Jevsky, who not only plays what Beethoven wrote, but he also adds some improvisation in more or less Beethoven style. Let's listen to this.
Thank you.
the scherzo movement from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 29 in B-flat, Opus 106, known as the Hammer Clavier Sonata, performed by the composer and pianist Frederick Zhevsky live in concert. If you know this piece well, you probably noticed that Zhevsky added some improvisation in addition to what Beethoven wrote. Oh, I wonder what Beethoven would have made of this performance. But after all, Beethoven was the greatest improviser of his day, so maybe he would have sympathized, or maybe he would have been appalled. I have no idea. I myself have improvised on Beethoven. I'm guilty of that. A few years back, when I played his 32 variations in C minor, I actually improvised a cadenza before the final section, the coda. And I also wrote this little piece I'm going to play for you now that I call the 32 Sonatas of Beethoven. It's basically a reduction of all the sonatas. I bring it all within a 60-second frame, time frame. That was a piece by yours truly, Jed Distler. It's a little piece called The 32 Sonatas of Beethoven, where I basically reduced them all down to around 60 seconds worth of music in extremely digested form. I think you might remember, some of you will remember, when Reader's Digest magazine would bring out abridged novels. So this is my digest version of the Beethoven sonatas. I was at the piano, by the way. I'm actually taking longer to talk about this silly piece than it actually takes to perform it. So I think now that David Dubal and I have fortified ourselves with more coffee, we should talk about someone whose name always comes up in conversations about Beethoven interpretations, and certainly on both of our programs. I'm talking about the great pianist and teacher and musical thinker, Artur Schnabel. We look at Artur Schnabel as somebody quite iconic because he recorded all of the Beethoven sonatas.
Let's talk of Schnabel for a minute, because he is that high status, that great champion of the sonatas. He brought them to a world public, but more than that, he codified the idea of music now will be a very serious thing in the world. You don't even play an encore for the fans. In many ways, that was harmful, because he was a very big form pianist. And if you listen to the sonatas, you follow with his own addition. He doesn't follow anything at all, basically. And he never said to follow him. He said that was the moment. People lived in the moment much more. He made those recordings. He said he never heard any of them. He didn't care. In the world of...
I think he cared more than we give him credit for.
Probably, but I mean, you know, in the sense that he's not going to go home and put on, you know, 478s and listen to himself.
No, of course not.
The idea of even practicing was terrible. He was a composer, and he was a problematic and difficult composer, and he took that very seriously, if you read what he says. But he is, to me, the great European sonata player. He knows how to construct the B-flat Schubert better than anyone, or he has also a depth of spirit He, by the way, did not like any pianists. I mean, they were all a little bit here and a little bit there, but they were nothing compared to him. In his mind, he really meant that.
Although he did like Rachmaninoff. He wrote Rachmaninoff a letter thanking him for his Beethoven playing.
Yeah, but he would not have liked all of the Beethoven playing. He really liked his own playing.
What do you think is the most underrated aspect of Beethoven's musical personality? I think I know what mine is.
Well, let me ask you, what is the most underrated characteristic of Beethoven's musical personality?
I think it's his sense of humor. I think his sense of humor is really underrated because we deify this composer. We don't pay attention to the funny moments, especially in the serious pieces. What about the march in the Ninth Symphony?
Well, what about the march movement in the 101? That could be played very humorously, very savagely. It can be grotesque. There's so much leeway, but there's certainly so much humor in that too.
The Diabelli variation.
Grim humor.
Grim humor. And in the Diabelli variation.
Everywhere.
Bum-ba-dum. Bing, bing.
Yeah.
Bum-ba-dum. I will never forget hearing Charles Rosen play that variation and his timing of the, it's almost like a knock-knock joke. Knock-knock. Who's there?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or shave and a haircut. Two bits. That's the Beethoven equivalent. And when Charles Rosen played it, he slightly delays the answer in one phrase and the audience laughs.
Oh, wonderful. That's very unusual. That an audience laugh. They can laugh at literature. They could laugh at a painting. They could laugh at many, many theater. Oh, but the musical experience is a serious one.
I know. And there are so many moments like this in Beethoven.
Oh, he's the great humorist. There's no one.
Haydn is more of a slapstick comedian.
Yeah, exactly. He is.
Haydn is the Marx Brothers to Beethoven's Lenny Bruce.
Yeah. His humor is serious humor, Beethoven. It could be gruff, it could be beer-bellied, it could be sarcastic humor. There is this humor. And I'm afraid that certain people, even as great as Arau, who said, oh, there's no humor in music, you know.
He was wrong.
And yet, let's say...
No, but you have the proximity of death everywhere.
Yeah, yes.
He even found the proximity of death in a Hannon scale.
I know. Well, he was... I knew him a little bit, and he was a fascinating old country gentleman who loved to read Goethe's Faust, and I was in his...
that was his casual reading.
Yeah, his casual reading. And, you know, I was in his studio to interview him, and I wonder what he's practicing. You know, I go to the piano. There's nothing around. Everything is just these beautiful African sculptures. No indication of his great career. No Grammys or whatever they give you. So I go over to the piano, you know, discreetly. I look. What is he working on? Lulu. He's reading Lulu of Berg's.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is not funny.
No, not at
all. Yeah. But
at all.
Then we go to Arau, and again, that difference. We haven't talked enough about it, the difference between the live performance and the recording. As Schnabel had said, he played Opus 90 once at Hunter College, and he said it's the only time that he had ever played the finale of that to his liking.
Those last measures are such a surprise. Mm-hmm. It's like a little butterfly emerging out of an elegy, almost.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Why should Beethoven be important to composers today?
I think there's an easy answer to that. Beethoven, for me, represents the ideal marriage between form and content.
Yeah. That's what I had said. With the man had the sense of organization as no one had ever had.
He's also one of the greatest masters of transitions. Wagner, I think, was the composer who said that the art of composition is the art of transition.
Mm-hmm.
And Beethoven, what a genius at transition he was. And those tend to be my favorite moments in Beethoven works.
That's interesting, yes.
Yeah, I think certainly the long transition from the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, that pedal point leading into that big blast in the finale, it's so orgasmic, but this is one of the most incredibly calculated and calibrated transitions.
Well, the toil must have been heartbreaking. I mean, how he had the patience with the deafness, with the financial problems, with the love of his nephew who gave him so many problems. How did he concentrate on this level? We can't even imagine what kind of man he is. Sullivan in his book said something like his consciousness was so elevated that we can only call ourselves in the level of consciousness dogs compared to Beethoven.
Wasn't it Goethe who said that after meeting Beethoven, something to the effect of, I've never known or met someone with so much concentration and so much generosity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said that, but he also said something more important, because I don't think that he really liked Beethoven much. He was too gruff to this great courtier. Beethoven was an unruly, ugly guy in some ways, and Goethe, even at 80, was perfection of form in his body, in his head, everything. So I think that he may well, this apocryphal phrase, as they were moving away from Maria Theresa, as the police or whatever were moving away, she was going through, and he would say, like, you know, Tarzan, he would say to Goethe, I too am king. And more important than that probably apocryphal phrase is this, which is true. When he heard the Fifth Symphony, Goethe said, this man will destroy civilization as we know it. The great critic that he was is absolutely true. This is a man of the 18th century, basically, even with his Faust, his manners, his mode of living. And yeah, this new democratic world where, you know, Goethe wrote and Haydn and Mozart wore wigs, this man sometimes didn't even shave on one side and had no shoes at all during one winter. He couldn't think of that. He did crush civilization. He is our great democratic symbol. And that is one of the reasons we need him so much.
More than ever before, David.
Mm-hmm. More than ever before. For we're living in a time of such disorder that even subliminally, a person that would listen to a Beethoven work with even just some seriousness will come out with a more orderly view of the world. Not necessarily a more aesthetic view that he had, but something that penetrates everyone. And this is his, this is one of the great legacies of all time.
And this is why we are still drawn to him.
Yeah, and we have to be drawn to him. I think it was Ashkenazi that said he's now more important than ever. And you said it too, and I say it. Every generation has found him to be an inspiration beyond belief. He was the chief luminary of the 19th century, even though they could not compose sonatas like. But he, his being being there was a symbol also of the romantic spirit. And that's how, of course, the biographies got out of hand. But he was an unbelievable man.
The combination of the romantic spirit and also the moral sophistication.
Yeah.
The moral core.
There is, isn't there, a morality to his music.
An inevitability and a moral core,
mm-hmm.
And the generosity.
Well, the generosity was his whole life. He gave everything for this art.